Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, April 30th, 2014, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call on whether American law schools are failing. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to have a conversation with two experts, and to tell you a little bit more about it, I'm going to introduce our first expert, who is Mr. James Haynes. Mr. Haynes is a member of the Federalist Society's Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group. He also founded the Baltimore Lawyers Chapter of the society. He is a member of the ABA Judicial Division and serves as a volunteer moot court judge for the ABA Student Division. Mr. Haynes also volunteers in the moot court programs of several Washington, D.C. law schools. He is a former Maryland Assistant Attorney General and former senior attorney with the Maryland Injured Workers Insurance Fund. And in 2006, he was appointed by Labor Secretary Elaine Chao to the Employees' Compensation Appeals Board. So now I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Mr. Haynes, who is going to tell us a little bit more about the program and get the discussion started.
Thank you, Christian. We're very pleased to have as our guest today Professor Brian Z. Tamanaha. He is the William Gardner Hammond Professor of Law at the Washington University School of Law and the author of six books, including A General Jurisprudence of Law and Society, Law as a Means to an End, and Beyond the Formalist-Realist Divide. Our subject today is a book that Brian has written that appeals to a more general audience and also approaches topics that are not usually the subject of books by law professors. The title, Failing Law Schools, makes up the meat, the subject matter of the book makes up for what the title lacks in terms of subtlety, perhaps. Professor Tamanaha has written a book that describes the development of legal education in the United States, probably in the last 20 years or so, and offers a few observations, some of them trenchant, about ways in which law schools and the legal academy have gone wrong and ways in which they could do better. And I would emphasize at the very outset that Brian views this as really a positive book. And since it is about 3 years old, we will also be discussing some of the developments since this book was published. And it may not establish Brian's credentials entirely as a prophet, but it certainly establishes that he is a very keen observer of some of the trends both in the legal profession and in the legal academy. Brian, welcome.
Thank you, Jeff.
Well, how did this book get written? At the outset, it is a book that certainly would not make you any friends and might lose you a couple. What was it that prompted you to take up this subject and write a book about it?
Well, for a number of years, I wrote it actually 3 years ago, but it came out 2 years ago. It's just a lag time between beginning to write and it actually coming out. But for years, several years before that, I had been concerned about the rise in tuition. Before moving to Washington University, I taught at St. John's, and many of our students went out to become DAs and public defenders, and the debt level, as tuition went up, the debt level went up with it, and I began to wonder whether the kinds of jobs they obtain would be enough to pay the debt that they acquired while in law school. 3 years ago, this seemed to be developing to a crisis proportion because there had also been a significant contraction in the legal market in 2008. And meanwhile, law school tuition kept going up, and law schools admitted more students in response to the contraction in the legal market. And it was at that point that I thought I had to say something about the situation.
So outline for us, this book covers really a lot of themes, ranging, I guess, from the origin of the third year of law school, which Many lawyers kind of question why we have to be around for 3 years,
mm-hmm.
and also the effect, good and ill, of the ratings in U.S. News and World Report, as well as a number of other topics that you kind of bind together in painting the picture that you have. So what was it that led you to pick the particular subject areas that you have in this book?
Well, what I wanted to do is describe how we got to where we are today, and actually, again, going back 3 years ago. And part of the reason I wanted to do that is because I felt at the time that there wasn't a lot of awareness on the part of law professors, as well as the public, about the current situation in law school. So to do that, I had to sort of retrace back to the beginning. There's a conflict within legal institutions, and that conflict, as it turns out, has been around for over a century. And the conflict is between the interests and concerns of legal academics, law professors, and the interests and concerns of our students. Law professors see themselves as academics, as history professors do. And on the other hand, our students are coming to law school because they want to go out and become practicing lawyers. And this divide, interestingly enough, was there from the very beginning. And there were disputes within the bar about the necessity for law schools, about the length of time law school should be, about whether or not you can practice law immediately upon graduation or whether you need to sit as an apprentice for a time.
You're going back about 100 years now,
yes,
too.
Yes, I am going back 100 years, right. So it was interesting for me. I didn't know this history, but as I was looking into this, it was interesting for me to see that the initial position of the bar 100 years ago was that you cannot be admitted to the bar after merely academic, book learning, that you would have to do an apprenticeship. And the law schools lobbied quite heavily against that, with the understanding that this would hurt their attractiveness from the standpoint of students. You have to keep in mind that at the time you didn't have to go to law school to become a lawyer. So if they were going to be attractive, law schools felt that students should be eligible to sit for the bar upon completing the law degree. Now initially, the vast majority of law schools were just 2 years. And elite law schools lobbied for a three-year requirement, arguing that in the initial debates about this, the argument was that, well, medical school's 4 years, and law's much more complicated, so obviously we should at least be three. But in terms of substance, they didn't give any real strong substantive arguments for the three-year requirement, other than that it takes a long time to develop, the ability to analyze legal problems. But meanwhile, interestingly enough, there were many schools at the time, 100 years ago, that preferred the two-year model. Law schools until that point, the ones that existed, had been 2 years long. So the elite institutions lobbied for the three-year model, and ultimately they won out, and they won out by making this a requirement as opposed to a choice. So the book retraces this history and talks about the difference in positions between the organized bar and law schools, and then the difference in position between two-year law schools and three-year law schools. And through a series of choices that we made, we arrived at the three-year model that we have today. And again, I want to emphasize one piece of this was that the three-year model is an academic model of law schools as opposed to a practitioner-oriented model of law schools, which was one of the choices on the table in the very beginning. But through lobbying on the part of academic institutions, that model lost out.
Now, accreditation and the accrediting bodies also came along to kind of cement the primacy of an academic model. Is that right?
That's correct. And this, again, was through the lobbying efforts of academic institutions. They created the American Association of Law Schools, ALS, which today is really the governing body. I shouldn't say a governing body. It's another way of looking at it. It's a lobbying organization on behalf of law schools that the members of which are American law schools. That association worked in conjunction with the ABA, and then as members of the ABA, they created the ABA section on legal education and admission to the bar. So this was a member organization, and still is. Those members rotated through the ABA section on legal education and admission to the bar, and through that began writing accreditation standards and enforcing accreditation standards for law schools. So basically, legal educators are the ones that have been writing the rules, and the rules for accreditation have been justified on the grounds of providing high-quality education so that we have capable lawyers graduating and being admitted to the bar. As I document in the book, we've also used the accreditation standards in some ways that benefited ourselves, or our vision of what it means to be an academic law school. And one of the chapters talks about the civil antitrust suit filed by the Department of Justice against the ABA section on legal education, essentially charging...
What year was that?
I believe it was in 1996.
Yes,
charging legal educators with capturing the regulatory process for their benefit. And as I said, the ABA agreed to a nolo contendere resolution of the case, in which we were under a consent decree for 10 years that set limits on the number of legal educators who could be on these accrediting committees and so forth. So there's something concrete to reflect the fact that, at least as far as the Justice Department was concerned, we were using the accreditation standards to our own benefit.
Now, if I can ask you to pause for just a moment, because of the audience we have, I know there is a finely developed sense of irony. And isn't it correct that the ABA cited as one of the reasons for settling the Department of Justice action the high cost of litigating against the federal government?
Yes, I thought that was indeed an irony. I want to emphasize that the ABA section on legal education and admission to the bar is actually officially separate from the ABA. The reason for that is that the Department of Education would not allow essentially a trade body, the ABA, to have an accrediting function, so they had to be separate. And yet, even then, they still answer at some level to the ABA. So it's not quite the ABA that was doing it, although that was the ABA president who described the reasons for the nolo contendere plea as the high cost of defending the suit.
So, are there milestones here in terms of the development that? First of all, the kind of triumph of accreditation and a three-year model leading to eventually an antitrust action, leading eventually to apparently U.S. News and World Report ruling the world. Is that
right? Well, that was the next piece of things. And these are all independent developments, and some of them are connected. But certainly a major driver of the current situation is the rise of U.S. News rankings and their impact on law schools. Had an extraordinary influence and a harmful one, in, at least in the sense that law schools responded, the ways in which law schools responded to this prior to the dominance of U.S. News. There was no specific ranking that people paid attention to. When U.S. News began, it began early on in the early 90s, but it was essentially began as a poll. And very few schools were ranked, but then they developed the ranking over time, and once the ranking began to take on real influence, and this was in the mid 1990s, law schools then began to alter their programs in ways that basically tried to maximize their score under the ranking. And this is a kind of something you would predict would happen. If students started taking the ranking seriously, as they did, then law schools had to take the ranking seriously, as we did. And we then tried to maximize our score on each of the separate items that the rankings judged. And some of that maximizing was in terms of the programs that we created and the funding, but some of that maximizing was in terms of simple manipulation of the score, the employment scores, for example.
Would you go into that a little bit?
Well, as I talk about in the book, the USU's ranking credited employment results without specifying what kind of results those had to be. So some of the things that emerged out of it, and also credited employment results, but only for those people who are looking for a job. So some of the developments that occurred was, law schools not tracking down people who are unemployed and therefore not having information on them and therefore counting them as not seeking employment and leaving them out of the poll. Another thing that law schools did, and this was in the late 1990s, was to begin for the first time ever, really, hiring unemployed graduates into temporary positions that overlapped with the period that the poll counted. For example, the U.S. News poll counts two periods. One is employed upon graduation, so they'd offer these positions before graduation, so they count as employed on graduation, and employed 9 months after graduation. So these fellowships, we called them, would run until February, end of February in the subsequent year. So a student in these positions, and these were $10 an hour positions, would be employed, count as employed at graduation and 9 months after graduation. Now, I don't want to give the wrong impression. Not every school did this, but schools began to do this and began to utilize a number of different techniques to boost up their employment rates so that by the early 2000s, all of the law schools in the top 100 were reporting employment rates in excess of in the 90 percentile range. Whereas when the U.S. News began, I went back to all the early issues and looked at each of them. In the mid to early 90s, the employment rates actually would be much as you would expect, and that is the top law schools had employment rates in the 90%, and then below that it was in the 80%, and then below that it was in the 70%, and some were in the 60s. So there was a much more natural much natural range of employment results. By the mid-2000s, that essentially was gone, that even low-ranked schools were reporting high employment scores, and certainly all the schools in the top 100 were reporting employment in the 90 percentile range. Now, the legal market was better, but it wasn't better in the sense that would justify those kinds of scores.
So the schools would upon occasion, not all of them, simply not go out and try to find unemployed students.
Right. And if you count a student who was counted as not looking, who was classified as not looking, wouldn't be counted in the employment score. So I've just given you a couple examples, but there are various ways in which we did this. Schools also began to report the salaries in ways that also created an appearance that wasn't reflective of the entire class. So one way of doing this would be to report, for example, a median salary full-time private practice jobs. Now, if I create the category that way, I can report a median salary of $130,000. What was less obvious, at least to people who didn't do a careful investigation, is perhaps 20 or 25% of the class would have landed in that category. So we were advertising salary numbers that were very attractive, but actually reflected a much smaller percentage of the class than would have been obvious unless you did a quite careful scrutinizing of the numbers.
Incomes that 70 to 80% of the class would not expect to make.
Yes, it didn't even count. It didn't apply to them. And law schools weren't lying. It was just the way the categories were being crafted.
And in terms of once again, looking at LSAT scores, was that a category on the U.S. News and World Report?
Right. So that was another major, and this had a very big impact on law schools. So the major items in the U.S. News our faculty, or the reputation rating of the school, and this comes from a poll of faculty members, as well as a separate poll of members of the bar. One of the scandalous things about how the significance of this is that actually the response rate from members of the bar is often very low. As I recall, in one year they had 120 people respond back to that, and the number.
I fill out all the polls I get in the mail. I can't understand that.
Right, and it was so low that they actually started using 2 years, kind of running 2 year responses to try to bolster that. But in any event, another major thing that goes into the ranking are the LSAT and GPA medians. So what law schools started doing naturally was paying a great deal of attention to bringing those medians up. And one way we did it was we began shifting scholarships from need-based, which is pretty much what they were. The bulk of aid before the mid-1990s was in need-based aid. By the end of the 1990s, that had shifted to merit-based aid. And
now, this is scholarships and not loans, or is
this
all financial
aid? That's right. Now, Scott, let me explain specifically how this plays out. What merit-based aid comes down to is a cross-subsidy within the class in which the students below the median in the LSAT, I'll just focus on LSAT, the students, although it applies to GPA as well, so the students below the median at most law schools, up until recently, paid full price. And the reason for that is because their score has no value to the school. If the school is trying to shape its LSAT median, anyone above the median helps the school raise its median or keep its median high. Anyone below the median counts against that. So the result of our system was that the bottom half of the class was subsidizing the top half of the class. And the oddity of this, and it doesn't always work out that way, but often students with better scores do better and therefore obtain better results when they go out in the job market. They're getting the better paying jobs. So we set up a system, instead of everyone paying the same price, the students with the worse employment prospects coming out were paying, subsidizing the education of the students with the best prospects.
Students who were more likely to end up in the 75 to 80% that are not going to make $130,000 out of law school.
Right. Let me clarify something about that as well. At many law schools, just the top 10% are getting corporate firm jobs that pay that kind of money. This is just a matter of percentages. But the essential perversity of the program was the students least likely to land well-paying jobs coming in. Those students were paying for the legal education of the ones most likely to earn well-paying jobs. So that was the nature of the cross-subsidy that we had developed. Now, again, I want to emphasize this did not exist in this form before U.S. News began to have such a huge impact on law schools. Before that time, there was merit aid. It wasn't a lot, and most of the aid was need-based. The proportion of these has flipped. Now most of the aid is merit-based, and a small percentage is need-based.
Now, you also talk in your book about the job prospects of graduates from law school, and you've already touched upon it. I was interested in your book in a sort of a graph that represented the legal profession in terms of income, kind of looking like a camel with
mm-hmm.
two humps.
Yes, right.
And that was something that certainly when I applied to law school many years ago, was much too sophisticated for me to have ever figured out.
Right. Well, apparently it's not been around that long. Again, this was a development from the late 1990s. So let me explain what you're referring to. It's called a bimodal distribution of pay, in which there are two separate earnings humps. So the high earners, and that is roughly around 140 to 160, are corporate law firm jobs, first-year associates that earn that amount. Now, a relatively small percentage of graduates land that. In 2007, it was maybe 15%, but now it's about 10% or maybe a little bit less than that. After the contraction in the legal market that hit in 2009, corporate law firms cut their hiring classes, and it's firmed up a bit since then, but they haven't gone back to their previous size hiring classes. Now, that so 10-15% were landing in the 140 to 160 range, and then the next big hump is in the $45,000 to $60,000 range. And then in between these two, there are few people scattered across, but otherwise very few people. So you either, the point of this bimodal distribution is that you either land in very well-paying jobs and it turned out great for you, 140, 160, or you land in the $40,000 to $60,000 range in which at these debt levels, you're going to have difficulty. And what by law school tuition, let me add one other thing that the book talks about, which is essentially tuition nearly doubled from 2000 and 2001, from about 20, 22,000 into 2012 up to 40,000. This is average tuition at private law schools. So law schools were increasing their tuition every year, far in excess of the rate of inflation, essentially on the prospect that you could land one of these $140,000 to $160,000 jobs, when in reality most students didn't get that because that's the smaller earnings hump. So people were paying tuition that would have made sense if you were getting those jobs, when in reality a very small percentage were. Meanwhile, average debt levels were going up every year.
Now you talked about. Oh, go ahead. Yeah. If you had finished, I was going to sort of try to turn us a little bit toward the. You had talked about scholarship aid and the question of why law schools were able to increase their tuitions as dramatically as they did, and why it apparently made no difference in terms of the number of applicants. The number of applicants increased steadily.
That's right.
Up to the current recession, which we all know is in recovery. What was the role of loans, non-scholarship aid, encouraging that?
The availability of loans is what fueled the situation. Before I get to that, just for viewers who don't know, I just want to make clear that
we're listeners, Brian.
I'm sorry, for listeners who don't know, that several dozen law schools are now have tuition in excess of $50,000 annually, and in addition, living expenses runs $20,000 roughly. So if you pay full tuition at one of these law schools over 3 years, you pay in excess of $200,000 for a law degree. So just to put the numbers out there so people understand. Now, the question is, how can students afford to pay that kind of money?
Because they don't have jobs.
They're paying the money hoping for the job when they get out, but they have to pay the money up front. And so the answer, and this goes back to your question, is that the federal government has been providing the money, essentially no questions asked, and this is through the federal loan program. Now, prior to 2009, the federal government guaranteed loans by private banks, but the guarantee effectively did the same thing. If the loan's going to be guaranteed by the government, a bank would loan the money without making any evaluation of the likelihood of repayment because it didn't matter to them. Now the federal government loans the money directly. It's taken out the private banks from the student lending business. But the same process occurs, that is, students go to the law school. The law school has a financial aid officer who essentially helps the students fill out the form, sends the money to the federal government, and then the federal government deposits the money into the law schools, and then the law schools disperse the living expenses portion to the students. So as a result, students are now able to borrow the full cost of attending law school with basically no caps. Now, the rise in debt levels have, as I said, the debt levels have gone up every year. And this would not have been made possible if the federal loan program, for example, had set caps on the amount of money that schools would loan, either in general or at specific law schools where students wouldn't be able to obtain economic opportunities that could carry the kind of debt levels they're now carrying. Let me just give you an example again so you can see concrete numbers. The U.S. News and World Report published the debt levels of graduates. For the class of 2013, the graduates of Thomas Jefferson Law School had average debt in excess of $180,000. Now, to pay off that kind of debt, you need to have the best corporate law positions you can. But a significant percentage of Thomas Jefferson's graduating class didn't even land legal employment. So, and again, this is just one example. I don't mean to pick on them, but that they were number one in the average debt among their graduates. Now, I need to emphasize that this number actually understates their debt because it doesn't include undergraduate debt, and it doesn't include interest accrued while in law school. Several years ago, Congress removed the subsidy on the debt, so now as soon as you take out the first-year debt, it begins accruing interest. So the actual debt of graduates on graduation day is much higher than the average number.
So essentially, the students can be viewed in economic terms as simply the vehicles, the sheep, if you will, coming into the fold with this fleece of federal loans, which the law schools then harvest, and the students graduate, and they bear the obligation to repay.
Yes. I wouldn't quite put it in the terms that you did, but I think that's right, yes. You might say that law schools are maximizing federal loan revenue via their students. Now, obviously, that would be an outrageous way of putting it. From the standpoint of most legal educators, we're offering them an education in return. Where you can see some of this is there are schools that simply admit as many students as they can with very little concern about credentials and have been expanding the size of their entering class. And some of these operations do look like they have been set up to reap federal loan money.
Now, in more recent years, the number of applicants to law school has declined.
That's correct.
Maybe you wouldn't say precipitously, but noticeably.
Yes, quite dramatically, actually, yes.
And in order to sustain the cost structure, looking in economic terms, that a law school has, all of them, except for the very elite schools, will need to admit, if they're going to keep their numbers, students who are less qualified than the sort of the bottom line for students the previous year. Is that still the case?
Yes, that's correct. And let me refer back to the title of the book, Failing Law Schools. I meant that in several different senses. One is that law schools were failing in some sense to provide economic opportunities to our students commensurate to the levels we're charging. But another meaning in the book is that law schools are going to fail financially if we didn't change our cost structure. And that was the point of the penultimate chapter in the book in which I talked about various trends in which it looked like going forward enrollment was going to drop, the number of applicants. I talk about various trends in the book. And again, as I said, I wrote it 3 years ago. Now, this was coming on the heels of us admitting the largest entering class in history. In 2010, we admitted 52,000 students. That was the most students we'd ever admitted. And as I said, we were expanding our admissions right in the midst of a terrible recession in the job market, among the legal job market. But since then, the number of applicants has simply crashed. And again, let me give you a comparative statistic so everyone knows. In 2004, we had roughly 100,000 applicants to law school, 100,000. This year, for the class of 2014, we'll have something between 52 and 54,000. So it's been cut nearly in half. And let me add that in the interim, we've opened new law schools. New law schools have opened. So essentially, we are now going to be spreading around far fewer bodies among a significant number of law schools. The last time applicant numbers have been this low, it was about 30 years ago, and they were one-fourth fewer law schools. There are about 150 law schools, and we now have 203. So what this means is there are fewer bodies to go around. Now we're responding to this in a couple of ways. One is that law schools, and now I'm just giving you aggregate numbers. I'm talking about law schools generally. Mm-hmm. Law schools are in 2004 admitted about half of the people who applied. So 50% didn't get in anywhere. This coming year, law schools will admit somewhere between 75% and 80% of the applicants. That is, 4 out of 5 will get in somewhere. What that means is that students, law schools are admitting students that in previous years would not have gotten into law school and probably shouldn't have gotten into law school. So for this already began in 2013. A couple dozen law schools had median student LSAT scores below 150. And that's now reaching into the bottom 30% and the LSAT test takers bottom 30 to 40%.
Mm-hmm.
This past year, one law school had a median, that is half the class, with an LSAT below of 143, which is very low. So this is one consequence, that law schools are admitting students who in past years had no hope of getting into law school and shouldn't have been admitted to law school. The other consequence, and there's the good news in this, is that law schools are now reducing their prices. Some of them have done it explicitly. About a dozen law schools have announced tuition freezes or reductions in this past year. But even the schools that haven't explicitly reduced their tuition are actually offering scholarships much deeper into the class than they used to in prior years, larger scholarships. In other words, at this point, law schools are just interested in getting bodies in the seats and will take half tuition over an empty seat. And so law schools are now competing with one another through tuition discounting.
Will we be seeing William Shatner doing ads for discount
I don't know.
Law school admissions, sort of a price line or something?
Yeah. It's a tough time, and I expect a few law schools to fail. I don't know which ones. Standalone law schools are in a difficult position because they don't have any university to fall back on, and Moody's recently downgraded the bond rating for a number of law schools precisely because of the fall in applicants. We all face a difficult time going forward.
Now, you had in your book, you also, in terms of naming names perhaps, you also discuss Yale Law School.
Mm-hmm.
And the degree to which the inflation in law school tuitions,
mm-hmm.
can be attributed to trends that emerged out of elite law schools.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't want simply to touch upon Thomas Jefferson down
yeah,
there.
No. I mentioned Yale, but the point I made was that elite law schools every year raise their tuition without any concern about the implications these increases would have for their own graduates. And had they tempered their increases, then law school tuition nationwide would be lower. And the reason I made the statement is because the tuition pricing system is a prestige pricing system, so the most elite charge the most. And as they kept going up, every other law school raised its tuition sort of under their wing, so we all went up together. I'm not holding, by any means, Yale personally responsible, and their response to my argument, I think correctly, is to say, well, for our students, it was worth it. And they could still go out and earn economic opportunities that made that price worth paying. And in that sense, they're correct. On the other hand, I can't say say the same about all the rest of law schools out there who went up as well. So really, I was just pointing out the implications of a prestige pricing system and suggesting that to the extent that Yale has any care, or not just Yale, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, all of them together, about the external consequences of their pricing, this is something I wanted to bring to their attention, that what you do has consequences far beyond your own institution. Now, as I said, it's difficult to blame them given the fact that their students are doing pretty well.
Now, you also talked a little bit about the different roles played by law school faculty and law school administrators in this process of declining job opportunities and increasing tuitions. And you are, of course, a member of a law school faculty, and you also served as a dean. So you've kind of seen both sides of the coin. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, it would seem that someone ought to have put on the brakes, or there should have been perhaps a voice of reason or moderation. But apparently there wasn't.
No, there wasn't. And let me clarify one thing you said. We don't have any control over the job market. I mean, what we do is we control our own institutions. And even then, certainly law schools that are part of broader universities have to answer to the university. What we didn't do is, I argue in the book, exercise our own restraint about our activities, about paying attention to price and the consequences for students and for our society generally about pricing a law degree so high. The main focus, when I talk about the faculty in the book, it's really about what we do. And I tried to show that in the last 10 to 15 years, as I mentioned in the beginning, we've always had this divide between the fact that we're academics in an academic institution, but our students want to be trained as lawyers. It's a rough balance that you have to keep between the two, but in the past two decades, our priorities have shifted very heavily in the academic direction. Our course loads were reduced. We spend much more time and resources on producing scholarship. In fact, in recent years, law schools have hired people with PhDs and JDs and some without JDs. That's how academic we're becoming, and many PhD JDs with no legal experience. So over time, the balance between our scholarly activities and the fact that we should pay attention to the fact that we're training lawyers got out of whack, and that's what I covered in chapters focusing on our priorities and how we paid attention to this. Now, we were responding to the incentives in our own environment. That is, we are rewarded for scholarly production. That reputation rating is based on scholarly profile. And again, this was a factor in U.S. News, but it's a factor in universities generally. We have this star professor system in which people get recruited. So on the faculty end, I was talking about that. On the administrative end, which I didn't say a great deal about, but it's the same thing that administrations like faculties have expanded. Basically, we were getting all this money, and what we did was spend it on, hiring more professors, having them teach less and write more, and building administrations. And administrations have gotten much larger. And this is where the money's been going to, that and nice buildings.
Some very nice buildings.
Yes.
Now, toward the end of your book, you have a chapter entitled Going Forward. And we've dwelled a little bit in this conversation, maybe because of my schadenfreude, but about some of the problems of law school professors. And there is a future, and there are trends that can be sort of addressed going forward. And I particularly wanted, because people who are going to read your book are going to also be saying, well, you know, this guy Brian, has he got anything constructive to say? You do. So I wanted to particularly give you a chance to talk about that.
Okay. One key proposal I was arguing for is to allow greater differentiation among law schools. We've all more or less followed the academic institution model, but law schools can be set up in a way that focuses on training our students to become lawyers. And there are examples out there. You know, one of the things in doing the research is the antitrust suit actually was prompted by the ABA's denial of accreditation to Massachusetts School of Law. So their model is, we're not going to hire a lot of academics. We're going to hire people who are going to teach a bunch of courses. We're going to hire adjuncts as lawyers and judges, pay them decent salaries. But as a result of this, because you're not subsidizing the production of research, the overall price can be much lower. So Massachusetts School of Law tuition, I don't know what it is today, but it was around $17,000 last time I looked, is much more reasonable compared to what at many schools now is, you know, $35,000, $40,000, $50,000. So essentially I was arguing that the ABA should accredit schools like this. There's no reason why a school like that should not be an accredited law school, and then allow schools to find their own market niche in terms of how much they want to allocate to scholarly research and how much they don't. And so the elite schools like Harvard and Yale will continue being what they are. And meanwhile, other schools can provide a much more affordable program. So that's one positive thing, just greater differentiation, strip out the requirements that are there mainly for the protection of faculty and scholarly production. The second, I think, really essential change that has to happen is in the federal loan program. Limits must be set on the availability of federal funds. And educators argue about opportunity and access and so forth. You know, part of the problem with that is that, indeed, students do need loans, and that's because the cost is so exorbitant. And so we're actually responsible for creating opportunity barriers. But one of the things I learned early on in my career, 20 years ago now, was that available loan amounts are lower, schools will price themselves under the limit, and that's because we have no choice. So the federal government has to set some restrictions, either in terms of caps or in terms of evaluations of the likelihood of repayment or some other way that puts downward pressure on tuition. Now, having said that, I should now acknowledge that downward pressure is already happening because students are not as willing to come anymore. So in that sense, the market is helping take care of some of this. But there are still institutions open today that are able to, that their students are able to borrow sums of money that under no rational system would be made available to them simply because the economic return is not there.
So at least in those particular points. Now, do you foresee a contraction just in the number of law schools from 200 to something under that?
I would be surprised if no law schools close, but I don't know. I'd also be surprised if many do. And the reason, unless the decline continues to shockingly low levels, which I don't see happening, there are always enough people who want to become a lawyer, and you know that's a good thing because our society needs lawyers. And one of the reasons I think we won't see that many law schools closing is that, in terms of universities, I learned in my service as interim dean for a year and a half that law alums matter to universities. They contribute to universities, and no alum would be happy to hear that their own institution no longer exists. In standalone law schools, there's even more reason to think that they'll hang on as long as they can, because that's essentially voting themselves out of a job. If a school closes, everyone's let go. So schools will only close if they have absolutely no choice. What I do foresee happening is that financial resources are much more restrictive for law schools going forward. I think there's a good chance that, and not good chance, it's already happening, that law school faculties will shrink, our teaching load will go up, our pay may well go down. We have to adjust financially because, like any business, we have revenue and expenses, and they have to at some point match up. So I think we will be dramatically reduced in terms of our size, our footprint, the amount of money we have and spend. But I'd be surprised if many law schools go out of business.
Now, I want to just make an observation of my own. That,
mm-hmm.
that one of the things that that I liked and enjoyed about your book was the start and the conclusion. You have two very different sorts, and this is an unusual book. I mean,
mm-hmm.
anybody who's listened to what we've said got to be scratching their head a little bit, saying this does not sound like happy talk or institutional development. But you talk about why you wrote the book,
mm-hmm.
and you put it in two very sorts of, I think, different kinds of contexts.
Mm-hmm.
If we're kind of winding down here a little bit, would you talk about the opening of your book and the conclusion of your book?
Sure. The opening book was just a brief statement of the experience I had when I was interim dean, and in which I discovered that, you know, faculties are a very difficult animal to wrestle with, that we're our own bosses. Really, no one tells us what to do. Our conditions of employment are excellent. I mean, that's the only way to say it. We do what we want outside of our few hours of teaching a week, and no one tells us what to do. Because we have tenure, the administration has very little leverage over us. So a professor who wants to do at least be on cruise control can work maybe 15 hours a week. And it's hard to get them to do any more. So the first chapter was really just about the experience I had in trying to find ways to get professors to work harder. Now, again, I need to emphasize a lot of professors work very hard, but some don't. And unlike most businesses, you can't fire them. And that creates some strange incentives and dynamics within law faculties. And also, I should add, because the dean cannot remain a dean long if the faculty revolts against the dean. And again, this is also something in the ABA accreditation rules. In the final chapter, it was just really raising a scenario about a student and asking law professors to reflect to themselves whether or not they would recommend their own school to a student, if that student was the son or daughter of your best friend from high school. And one of the reasons I raise that is because I think that's a very tough question that many law professors are at selling a product to consumers, to students, that they wouldn't themselves buy or that they wouldn't recommend to someone close to them. And that was just a way for me to urge fellow legal educators across the country, if you can't answer this question yes, if you can't with a good conscience recommend to the son or daughter of a good friend to come to your own school, then what are we doing? And that's basically just sort of an appeal that I tried to make to get us to think about our operation.
Well, I think I think it puts your book into a very worthwhile sort of perspective in terms of bracketing the material, some of which is very diverse that you have in between. I'm sure that people are getting a little bit tired of hearing from me, so I don't know if Christian has any questions or not. But Professor, before we close, is there anything that you would like to add that I might not have sort of halfway covered in our conversation?
No, Jim, thank you. Your questions were very good.
All right. Well, this is Christian. I think it's about 12:55. I think we've got time to maybe do one question, if that's okay with the both of you.
That's fine.
All right. Well, for those of you, we've got over 50 people on the line. So if you have a question for Professor Tominaha, in a minute you'll hear a prompt that will say press star and the pound key to ask a question. Again, that's star and the pound key. And for anyone asking a question, one note, since we are running low on time, please do try to keep your question brief, and please make sure there actually is a question involved in your statement as well. So star and then the pound key. Also, one quick programming note, please do join us next week on Wednesday, May 7th, 1 week from today, for our second annual Executive Branch Review Conference here in Washington, D.C. Attendance is free, and CLE credit is available for a nominal fee. All right, looks like we've got one question to go to.
Clearly, this seems like a widespread and institutional problem across the board. And you indicated that the federal government may have a role in setting caps for student loans. I guess my question is, have there been any congressional hearings? Why haven't there been any congressional hearings if there haven't been? And frankly, what do we need to do to create some congressional interest to make this an issue that perhaps Congress should be looking at?
Well, this is a great time for it because Congress is now reauthorizing the Higher Education Act. And as a part of that reauthorization, I believe it's essential that they look at the Graduate Plus loans in particular. These are the loans that that law students borrow from, and these loans have no caps to them. In addition, Congress needs to take a look at the income-based repayment program, which there was a recent report in the Wall Street Journal, and about the ways in which law schools are using the income-based repayment program to tell prospective students, don't worry about the size of the debt. If you things don't work out, it'll be canceled in 20 years. So now is actually a very important time, and what can make the Congress pay attention to that? I don't know. I mean, I'm hoping there's enough out there that they'll take a look at that, take a look at all of these issues.
Excellent. Well, we are running up against the end of the hour, so on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both Mr. Haynes and Professor Tominaha for being with us today. Thank you to our audience for calling in. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. Please do consider joining us next Wednesday in Washington, D.C. for our second annual Executive Branch Review Conference. And note that this teleform will be posted on our website for use as a podcast in the future. So until then, thank you all, and we're adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.